This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. I'm Ted Chen from NBC4, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a great Thursday. Well, it turns out that Americans actually vote against their own interests. That's according to the author we have in studio. In his new book, The Political Mind, George Lakoff explains that human beings are not the rational creatures we imagine ourselves to be. According to his research, conservatives understand that most brain functioning is grounded not in logical reasoning but in emotionalism combined with reasoning. And therefore, Lakoff says, as long as liberals believe that people will use an objective system of reasoning to decide on politics, Democrats will continue to lose elections. George Lakoff, author of The Political Mind, Why You Can't Understand 21st Century American Politics with an 18th Century Brain, is a Richard and Rhoda Goldman Distinguished Professor of Cognitive Science and Linguistics at the UC Berkeley and a senior fellow at the Rock Ridge Institute. And he joins us in studio. Professor Lakoff, thanks for coming in.
A pleasure to be here.
Okay, let's talk about why we can't understand 21st century American politics with an 18th century brain. What are you referring to there?
Well, this country was founded on Enlightenment principles, political principles like freedom and equality, democracy, and so on. And with that came a view of the mind that said we all have universal reason, and that's why we can have democracy. We can reason for ourselves. We don't have to have nobles or kings reasoning for us. And that's right. Along with that came a view of what reason is that came out of Rene Descartes in the 1600s, mm-hmm. and it's become popular. It's part of a normal view of reason. It goes like this, that reason is conscious, that you know what you're reasoning, that it's abstract, that it can fit the world directly as it is, that it's logical, and therefore if you know the facts, you'll reason to the right conclusion, that it's dispassionate.
And disembodied.
It's disembodied and dispassionate, that emotion gets in the way of reason, and that the purpose of reason is to fulfill our self-interest. That's the usual view. What cognitive science and neuroscience has found out in the last 30 years is that every one of those is false. And that is turns out to be important because what it does is give you a different idea of what reason really is.
And that reason and emotion are inexorably linked.
They're inexorably linked. So, for example, first, 98% of reason is unconscious. 98%. It's what your brain is doing when you're busy being conscious. But your brain is doing a lot. Moreover, it's not just disembodied. You think with your brain. You have no choice, and therefore you're actually reasoning with neural circuitry. But that neural circuitry is not general purpose. It is set up to run your body. Your brain is highly structured to run a body. So you're reasoning with something that's there to run a body. Is it dispassionate? No, it's not dispassionate at all. It turns out that if you have a stroke or a brain injury that keeps you from feeling emotion, you don't become super rational like Mr. Spock. It's the reverse. You can't function rationally at all because you wouldn't know what to want. How would you know what to want if you know whether you'd like it, not like it, if that didn't make any sense, or you couldn't tell whether people would be mad at you or like you? So you can't make decisions. But even more so, the emotional pathways that we have are actually linked to conceptual parts of the brain in circuits that are single integrated circuits. And you see this in melodramas. You see this in cultural narratives that we have, like a hero-villain narrative. You have a hero. Suppose you have a villain that does something awful to a victim. You feel angry about it. The hero encounters the villain. You don't know who's going to win. You feel anxiety, fear. Then the hero wins and you feel triumphant, happy. Okay, those are there's a semantic part that is a conceptual part that's due to heroes, villains, and so on, and an emotional part. And there's a single circuit for that. And we have dozens, if not hundreds, of those kinds of narratives in our brain. But moreover, we live them, like a rags-to-riches narrative, for example. And you see them in politics. So Obama has a rags-to-riches narrative. You have a hero narrative by McCain. You had a glass ceiling narrative by Hillary Clinton. And these are things that are there in our culture. And not only do we, each of us, live them out and try to avoid some, but we appreciate other people in terms of those. And that means our reason is not fitting the world directly as it is. It's fitting it through our brains and through those narratives. And then it's not the case that we just think in terms of self-interest. We have what are called mirror neurons. That is, there's a part of the brain, the premotor cortex, that has neurons that fire when you either perform an action or you see someone else perform the same action. And those neurons are connected to the emotional regions. And as a result, you can look at somebody, see what their body is like, see if they're being, if they're happy or sad or in pain. And you can tell that because of this mirror neuron system, that is, we are physiologically built for empathy.
And let's move this to the political realm. And as you argue in your book that that conservatives and by extension Republicans better understand this, that our brain has this fusion of logic and reason, these narratives, metaphors, is mm-hmm. what you actually call them, and are better able to appeal to those and understand those better.
Right. That this comes out of marketing. The conservatives have a huge industry of think tanks and messaging. So they spend about $400 million a year on think tanks, over $4 billion in the last 35 years or so. And they have a large messaging system where they train conservative leaders to think and talk and use a language of conservatism. And they've been doing this for 35 years.
Like war on terror.
Like war on terror, getting those messages out, or death tax, or all sorts of expressions of this sort that evoke structures called frames that are neurally there in your brain. And the frames are normal. They're things you think in terms of normally. And they can be used either to fool you or to honestly express an opinion. And a lot of Democrats are not aware of how this is really working. They believe in the old view of reason, that reason just fits the world in itself, and if you just tell people the facts, they'll reason to the right conclusion, and that any framing is an attempt to fool people. Well,
and all people will reason the same way.
And the assumption is all people reason the same way. It turns out there is a conservative mode of thought and a progressive mode of thought. They're very different. And we all have both of them, but in different areas of life. So there are people who are conservative about financial matters and progressive about social matters, or conservative about foreign policy and progressive on domestic policy, or any combination of those. And it turns out that that's a very important thing, because that's what swing voters are about. And that's how you have a chance to, if you're Obama, trying to unify the country by looking at people who share his views, at least partially.
Our phone number is 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. We'd like your thoughts on this. We're talking to author George Lakoff. The book is The Political Mind: Why You Can't Understand 21st Century American Politics with an 18th Century Brain. And he writes in his book on how progressives and by extension Democrats have failed to understand that logic and reason and emotion go together in the brain, and thus have been ineffective in furthering their ideas and their agenda, and uses plenty of examples, including some of the terms and the framing that we just mentioned, war on terror, et cetera. And also you talked about how a Congress last year in 2007, with regard to the funding of the troops in Iraq, was also the Democratic majority was ineffective in recognizing this. 866-893-5722 is our number, 866-893-KPCC. In one of the first parts of the book, you talk about Anna Nicole Smith and why it is such a relevant story to understanding your point, and how because a lot of people don't understand why the news covered it so much and why it was such a big story. And it was because that story appealed to these narratives and these metaphors in people's heads.
Yes. It was actually quite a remarkable thing. When she died, I watched a lot of the coverage and analyzed it in detail. And there were a great many women, especially from the South, who called up mourning her death, seeing her as a great hero who had died and seeing this as a terrible tragedy, whereas other people saw her as a kind of floozy, a gold digger, or maybe a celebrity who had no talent but was a celebrity because she was a celebrity. And you had these different views of Anna Nicole Smith. And it was quite fascinating. If you take a look at, say, the people who saw her as a hero, she was born in Houston. She was very poor. She uneducated. She didn't even get past the freshman year of high school. If you are a woman in the South who doesn't have any money, who doesn't have an education, what do you have going for you? Well, your looks and your grit. And what she did was manage to make a life out of that. Starting as a waitress in a restaurant, and then getting pregnant when she was 16, trying to raise a kid by herself, becoming a go-go dancer, getting breast implants, learning how to be a model, meeting a billionaire at one of these strip clubs, getting friendly with him, later marrying him, meanwhile becoming Playboy. Playmate of the month, then Playmate of the Year, then a model for Guess Jeans. She sort of worked her way up. And for a lot of women in the South who started out in the same way, this was a heroic life. This was a heroine. This was a marvelous person who actually did this. And people liked her. She was everybody reported she was a fun person to be around, a very nice, caring person. And you have that. And then you have people who saw her marrying this billionaire who was 50 or 60 years older than she was. He was, in a wheelchair. They thought she was just a gold digger. And her view of it was, no, he was the first man who ever appreciated her. And for who she was. And you get these different stories, different narratives. The man who loves me for who I am versus the gold digger. These are traditional narratives of American life, and they're all imposed on this one person. And there were dozens of them. If you actually look at what people said about Anna Nicole Smith, you get a view of American culture as a whole that was quite remarkable. And every one of these narratives is emotional. Everyone has people either liking her, hating her, being angry at her, being bored with her, just and so on.
And we're going to talk about how these narratives in the Anna Nicole Smith story cross over into politics and how they're used more effectively, in your view, by conservatives and Republicans. Our phone number, 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPCC. Back with author George Lakoff. The book is The Political Mind, Why You Can't Understand 21st Century American Politics with an 18th Century Brain. This is Air Talk on KPCC.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the Hollywood Bowl, presenting Bugs Bunny on Broadway on July 5th at 8 p.m. This evening of cartoon hilarity features classic Looney Tunes like What's Opera Doc, The Rabbit of Seville, and many more, projected on the Bowl's big screens, while the Los Angeles Philharmonic accompanies them live with a quintessential cartoon music. Tickets and information available at HollywoodBowl.com. The Hollywood Bowl, part of your life.
Programming is supported by Air France, with up to 3 daily nonstops from LA to Paris and a daily nonstop from LA to London. Air France, offering the French touch. Details at www.airfrance.com/US.
This is 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Your boss can't read your text messages unless you say so, even when you send them from a company cell phone. The U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled yesterday that what happens on your phone stays on your phone. KPCC's Brooke Binkowski reports.
The ruling follows a lawsuit by an Ontario police sergeant and three others against the city, its police department, and the city's service provider. 6 years ago, Sergeant Jeff Kwan and another officer went over the provider's monthly limit for text messaging. The service provider sent the Ontario Police Department transcripts of the texts at the police chief's request. City investigators said they needed the texts to figure out whether the officers were using the phones only for work. The city found that many of the messages were personal in nature. Very personal. That discovery prompted the officers to sue. The court determined that the City of Ontario had violated the plaintiff's constitutional right to freedom from unreasonable searches. It said the employees had a reasonable expectation that those messages would remain personal. Brooke Binkowski, 89.3 KPCC.
It's 11:21 at 89.3 KPCC.
This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Ted Chen from NBC4, sitting in for Larry Mantle. We continue our discussion with George Lakoff, the author of the book, The Political Mind, Why You Can't Understand 21st Century American Politics with an 18th Century Brain. George will be speaking and answering questions tonight about his book at Pasadena's All Saints Church at 7 p.m. For more information, you can go to KPCC's website or go to romansbookstore.com. And I kind of touched on this on the break, but George, I want to, because you talk about how frames and narratives that are inherent and unconscious in our brain affect the way we make political decisions, and that conservatives have been more effective in understanding that and reaching that through slogans and the way they frame issues. And I'm wondering if we, to what extent do we all start with the same narratives and frames, and thus are equally susceptible to persuasion by either side?
We don't all start with the same ones, although we learn both a conservative mode of thought and a progressive mode of thought, but you might have one being a lot stronger than the other and applying to many more cases. So you might grow up as a progressive and be progressive at every part of your life, but you might go to a movie, and a John Wayne movie, and you'll understand it, and you'll see that there's a conservative mode of thought there. Or you might be the reverse. You might be conservative in most things that you do, but you could turn on Oprah and understand it. And what you have is two modes of thought, and very, very many people are, you know, progressive on certain things and conservative on others. And there's a certain system to it, and I'll talk about that tonight. And that matters for communicating with people. But what conservatives have done is gotten their major ideas out there through marketing. They've marketed their ideas about what government is, what national security is, what taxation is, what the market is, what responsibility is, what accountability is, all sorts of their ideas that have been out there for, you know, 30 to 40 years now, over and over. And what they've done also is created a conservative populism. That is, 40 years ago, most working people assumed correctly that liberal Democrats were their champions. That started to change by conservatives who first started talking about the liberal elite, the liberal media, the, you know, the limousine liberals, the latte liberals, etc. And they kept saying over and over they were looking down on working people, while the conservatives understood a lot of working people were liberal about their unions and their view of nature, perhaps, but were conservative often about their family life and certain social issues. So what they did was mainly talk about family values and social issues to them, thus activating their conservative part of the brain. And they inhibited their liberal part of the brain by insisting on talking about the liberal elite. And in what they wound up doing was creating a conservative populism that voted against its own economic interests, but for its identity.
And how do you believe progressives can counteract that?
Well, it's difficult because it's 40 years of stuff. But I think the major way to counteract it is to understand that people who are conservative populists have certain progressive ideas very strongly. They'll love the land, for example. They want to live in progressive communities where people care about each other and work together. Often they are progressive Christians who believe in being good stewards of the environment and worrying about people who are poor and AIDS in Africa and people who don't have health care and people who are homeless and want to build houses for them and so on. By appealing to the progressive side that a lot of working people who see themselves as conservative have, and by talking about that over and over, you can activate that part of them more. And then you want to also talk about how that affects their working life.
Let's go to a phone call. Bill in Diamond Bar. Bill, good morning. Welcome to Air Talk.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead, sir.
I've been a conservative since Nixon was president. actually the first time he ran. But lately I've been thinking some pretty liberal ideas, like national health care is like a good idea. What kind of brain do I have?
I didn't hear that.
Professor,
I missed it.
Bill from Diamond Bar talks about how he's been a conservative his entire life, but lately his thoughts seem to be changing, and he's wondering what's happening.
Well, what's happened is that you've identified yourself with a conservative mode of thought, but probably you've always had what I've called a nurturant way of thinking. That is, thinking about people where you care about them, where you see government as protecting people and empowering people. And part of protection is police protection and so on. But with health care, it's a very interesting thing because, you don't want to have a system where you call the police when someone's breaking into your house and they say, what kind of premiums do you have? Have you paid your premiums recently? What police maintenance organization do you have before we go in and see who's breaking into your house? Or the same with fire. Healthcare, you understand as protection. And that's, I think, what's going on here. That is, you're taking your understanding of protection by the police and fire department and applying it to healthcare.
George, are you plugged in there? Just want to make sure you're plugged in and you can hear the calls.
I can now.
Okay, great. Yes. Let's take a phone call. Jonathan in Redlands. Jonathan, welcome to Air Talk. Good morning.
Hi, Mr. Lakoff. Hi, Ted.
Good morning. Go ahead.
I ran for office in this primary season on June 3rd. And in one of the little op-ed wars I had with the Republican assemblyman in our district, I found that he was using that frame of, especially in terms of taxes, that's what the argument was about. And his argument was, Californians want tax relief, period, that's it. And it resonated a little better than my argument that, which was a little more nuanced and, backed up by tons of research and stuff, which said that, we might be willing to pay slightly higher taxes if we got services, in the Inland Empire, let's say for jobs closer to home. And I think his argument resonated better because it fit in with the frame.
And that was his big mistake, lots of research and numbers.
Right, because the research and numbers don't really do it. He has the frame in his favor. But the frame that you have and other Democrats have to put forth is the idea that the role of government is protection and empowerment. And protection is, police protection, military protection, but also worker protection, consumer protection, safety nets, environmental protection, and empowerment, a very important thing, has to do with building roads and communication systems, but also having a banking system where you can get bank loans and having a stock market run by the SEC and having a court system for contracts. And no business, no corporation can make a dime in this country without government protection and empowerment. Taxes are what you pay to be an American and not a citizen of a third world country that doesn't have any of these things. And the person who said it best was Warren Buffett, who said, if you dropped me in Bangladesh 30 years ago, I'd still be impoverished because they didn't have a banking system and they didn't have a stock market.
And you argue that Republicans have somehow framed the issues to make government empowerment of corporations okay, and yet government empowerment of individuals,
not
a problem.
Not only that, but to hide the government empowerment of corporations. That is, it doesn't say the government is allowing corporations to function through having a court system, upholding the banking system, and so on. They're not saying that. They're not saying that's why we should have taxation to run such a system. And, of course, they're not saying it about individuals where they say all we should have is individual responsibility and everybody should be able to take care of themselves when, in fact, you don't just take care of yourselves. You don't build the roads you drive on. You don't build the communication system you use. You don't build your own banking system or your own court system. You live in a place that has these, and you don't build your own police force and fire department and so on. Nobody lives on their own. Nobody makes a dime on their own in this country.
Our phone number, once again, 866-893-5722. We're talking to author George Lakoff. The book is The Political Mind, Why You Can't Understand 21st Century American Politics with an 18th Century Brain. 866-893-KPCC for your questions for George Lakoff. Let's go to Jill in Los Angeles. Jill, good morning.
Hello. I have a question regarding the Hillary campaign and the supporters of Hillary who have now refused to support Obama, which I find rather illogical. And I was wondering what the framing of that is, because their policies and their platforms seem very similar. And then that said, I mean, the idea of supporting McCain as opposed to supporting Obama. And that said, I was wondering if there was advice to Obama's campaign in how to deal with this.
Well, I think they are dealing with it. I think the first thing, putting Michelle Obama on The View, is really a very good thing, because then a lot of women see women like themselves who really want to make something of their lives but also have children and have families and would like to be able to do that. I think that's the first big step. Michelle Obama is a great role model. In addition to that, one thing she talks about is the support, how supportive her husband has been, and how remarkable a father he's been. And that's another thing women want to hear. It's not just the policies on abortion and so on, which will eventually bring a lot of women into the Obama camp, because, you know, you have McCain who's got horrible positions on women's rights. But it's not just about women's rights. It has to do with the fact that the central idea in Obama's campaign is empathy, is caring about people. That's what the campaign is fundamentally about. That's what the change in hope is going toward a government that cares about people enough to be able to really take advantage of the power of the government to protect and empower people. That's something that I think women will understand and react to when they get a chance to see more of Obama and to see more of Michelle.
We should note that, it's apparent that you believe that these progressive ideals at heart are fundamentally superior to the conservative ideals. At least that's the sense I get from your book. And they just have used the framing improperly, and they just haven't made an effective argument.
Well, it's more than that. And notice that Obama never says that he's a liberal or a progressive, and there's a reason for it. When he's asked, let's say, by Anderson Cooper what patriotism is, he says patriotism begins with people caring about each other. He talks about empathy.
And that's reframing.
That is not just reframing. What he's saying is this is what the country is based on. This is the reason that we have principles like freedom and fairness. And he says that out clearly in various speech after speech, and nobody ever picks up on it. But it's important. Historian Lynn Hunt at UCLA has written a wonderful book called Inventing Human Rights. And she starts with the Declaration of Independence, which says we take these truths to be self-evident and, you know, so and so. And she says, when did they become self-evident? Well, it turns out that they became self-evident only about 25 years before the Declaration was written, about 1750, but on the basis of empathy through novels and paintings and drawings and dramas about how people who were wealthy and powerful were oppressing poor people, and through the empathy that you got. And it was through empathy that our basic principles in human rights were founded. Obama understands that very, very well as a student of history and of the Constitution, and that's what he says. He says these principles, starting from empathy and responsibility, are at the heart of American values, not progressive values, not conservative values, American values.
But you do mention, though, in your book that the candidates like John Edwards have tried to reframe issues. You talk about reframing terms reframing illegal immigration to illegal employment to focus more attention on the employers, I assume, on reframing war on terror to occupation of Iraq. Mm-hmm. And even if this issue of corporate empowerment versus government empowerment of corporations. So it is being done to some extent already, this attempt, and why hasn't it been as effective as progressives would like it to be?
Because over the past 35 to 40 years, conservative institutions have spent a lot of money and done a lot of training. They train tens of thousands of people to be spokesmen. They have own a lot of media, and they have a booking agency to book their intellectuals and their spokespeople on shows all over the country every day, repeating the ideas over and over. Progressives haven't done this because they have the old view of reason, because they think that reason just in itself will fit the world. They just have to tell people the facts. They'll reason to the right conclusion. Really, what they have to do is know that every word is defined relative to some frame. It's the most normal thing in the world. If you want to effectively express what you really believe, you have to frame things correctly. But framing can also be misused. It can be fraudulently used, and in many cases it has been. What I've been doing is trying to show exactly how all this works, how how reason really works. I'm not saying we're irrational, quite the opposite, that rationality is – there's a real rationality. It isn't what we were brought up to think it was, and we have to understand how the mind really works if we're not going to be fooled or taken in.
Let's go to John in Sherman Oaks. John, good morning. Welcome to Air Talk.
Hi. To be honest, it sounds like a lot of the old Herbert Marcuse cultural Marxism that has nothing to do with our Constitution. And as far as taxes, your guest was talking about the good taxes and the bad taxes aren't really taxes like all technology. There's appropriate taxes to a situation and a problem and a solution and inappropriate. Just turning around and endorsing big government and big taxes as the benevolent, kind way to deal with problems is as unscientific as giving corporations a tax break, which I'm not for either.
Try reading the book, which you'll see is the opposite of what you said. I'm not a follower of Marcuse, never have been. I'm for progressive capitalism, and we tell you what the difference is between a conservative and progressive form of capitalism. They're quite different, and that's what's important here. In addition, I think you're absolutely right. There are appropriate taxes and inappropriate taxes, and you have to be very careful about what they are. But the question is, what is the moral basis behind it? Are those taxes there to protect people? Are they there to empower people? And who are they empowering? These are very, very important issues. They're moral issues. Every budget and every form of taxation is a moral document. And yes, you're right, there are appropriate and inappropriate taxes. But the question is, what is the moral basis behind it? Is it about government really caring about its citizens and and its companies and its businesses? Or is it something where you just allow people to get as rich as they possibly can, no matter what the effect on most people are?
We only have a few seconds left, but last questions. Do conservatives have a point in that empathy as a progressive value can be overdone, and that it can lead to access and be misguided?
But that's not what empathy is. Empathy is always paired with the responsibility to carry out that empathy, which means you want people to become both self-reliant and caring about others, both.
All right. Thank you so much, George Lakoff, author of The Political Mind, Why You Can't Understand 21st Century American Politics with an 18th Century Brain. He'll be at All Saints Church tonight at 7 p.m. to talk about his book. And you can get more information on KPCC's website and also at romansbookstore.com. Coming up, we'll talk to author David Lita about his book on Mexico City.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by UCLA Mood Disorders Research Program, advising that millions of Americans suffer from bipolar depression and don't know it. Symptoms are current depression and periods in the past of increased energy, decreased need for sleep, and feelings of euphoria. If this describes your situation, you can call to learn about a research study conducted by Dr. Lori Altshuler on treating bipolar depression at 310-794-6663.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by Pasadena Water and Power. Landscape professionals advise that most people overwater their lawns by 50%. Overwatering weakens the root system and wastes water. If everyone in Southern California cuts outdoor watering one day per week, we could save 73 billion gallons of water per year. You can save water by irrigating only 2 times per week. For more information, you can go to PasadenaSavesWater.com. This is 89.3 KPCC online at kpcc.org. A new economic age is pointing up, though just barely. The Conference Board's Index of Leading Economic Indicators rose 0.1% in May. That equals April's number and points to slow economic growth. Also today, the Labor Department reports new claims for unemployment benefits dropped last week. Well, looks as if it'll be another hot one in the valleys with 100-degree-plus temps. News photographer Armando Hernandez knew when he woke up yesterday that he and his family needed to escape to the beach at Santa Monica.
Oh, probably about 85 degrees this morning at 8:30 in Van Nuys, so I always say we got to get out. And we were able to. Kids are out of school. My wife got the day off, and I don't have to work until 4 o'clock, so we come here and beat it with the heat.
The temperature in Van Nuys did top 100 yesterday. It's 11:41.
This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. I'm Ted Chen from KNBC, the Channel 4 News, sitting in for Larry Mantle. And this half hour, we are discussing his new book, Mexico City, First Stop in the New World, with author David Lida. He is a writer and journalist who has lived in Mexico City for much of the past 15 years, and he will be signing his book Saturday, June 21st, at the Mexican Cultural Institute at 5 p.m. That is in Los Angeles. And also Thursday, June 26th, at Libreria Martinez in Santa Ana. That's at 7 p.m. The book is First Stop in the New World, Mexico City, the capital of the 21st century. David Lida, thanks for joining us in studio.
Thank you for inviting me, Ted. I'm glad to be here.
You believe Mexico City is going to be the city in the 21st century the way New York, London, and these grand cities of the past are of the past. Why do you believe so?
Well, half the world's population lives in cities, Ted, and most of us do not live in neat, orderly cities like London or Toronto or New York or even L.A., believe it or not, is a very orderly city.
You don't say.
Compared to most of those people live in huge, chaotic hyper-metropolises like Mumbai, Shanghai, Karachi, Lagos. Cities that expanded monstrously in the last few decades that have populations of 10 million or more sometimes fighting over inches of space. Mexico City is the most populous city in the Western Hemisphere. It grew from 3 million to 20 million between, say, 1950 and 1990. And I think in that way it is very emblematic of all those other cities and the way so many people in the world live.
And the characteristic of these newer cities is that it's largely unplanned.
Exactly. They grew willy-nilly, ad hoc, with nothing that we would consider urban planning.
And you see that as a positive quality, though. Why?
Well, not necessarily, but I mean what I see as a really positive quality in Mexico City is the resilience, strength, and imagination of the people who live there, because they have had to mostly improvise their lives in a very spontaneous manner. That's what I've tried to do in the book is tell the story of the city through their eyes and their stories, because something like half of them live from the informal economy. I've got people who sell newspapers on the street and maids and I've also got the richest man in the world there. But the thing is, because he lives in Mexico City too. But the idea is that Chilangos, which is what people
the
from
locals.
Mexico City are called, they have to make up their lives as they go along, and I find it really positive, and I get very optimistic when I see how well they survive under difficult circumstances.
And one of the things that won you over is how the city has changed from when you first visited, it was 15 or 17 years ago, and during an era where some of its worst problems were at their heyday, and how it gained its reputation as a center of crime and overpopulation, and how it's evolved beyond that.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Ted. As long as I know Mexico City, say for the past 20 years, it's had a terrible reputation for one thing or another, or a combination of things: overpopulation, pollution, poverty, crime, what have you. But at the same time, it turns out to be a very livable place for a lot of people anyway. And I think it gets better all the time. It's more international. It's in terms of the cultural offerings like food, theater, music, film, art in museums and galleries. It's more along the lines of a first world city, say London or Paris, than any other city in Latin America. And the economy has improved. I mean, there's still a lot of poor people, and the money is really badly distributed, which is a problem. But the economy has improved there. And for instance, the terrible rap that it's had about pollution, it got a lot better in the last 15 years or so. All the new cars have had catalytic converters since the early 90s, and they got rid of most of the factories. There used to be 35,000 factories that ring the city, and most of them are gone now. It went from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. I think it's a very livable place.
And speaking of the economy, you write about how the peso, which crashed, of course, in the 90s, has largely stabilized.
The peso crashed periodically between, say, the 60s and the 1994. And it is unprecedented in, say, the past 50 years. The peso has been stable since 1994, which has really helped a lot to make the lives of people in Mexico City more stable.
How is Mexico City defined by its history? I mean, you talk about the War of Independence with Spain and the U.S. invasion in 1847 as its seminal moments. How has it created the Mexico City that we know today?
Well, it's really interesting. Mexico City is the kind of a place that wears its history on its sleeve. If you go right smack downtown to the Zócalo, which is the central square, you've got an Aztec temple that they unearthed when they were laying cable for telephone poles next to the Metropolitan Cathedral, which was built during the Spanish conquest in the 1600s. That was when it started. And then you've got these big government buildings that were built during the independence in the early 19th century. And around the corner, you've got a Starbucks. I mean, you can really see the whole all of the history within a few blocks in the Centro Histórico, which is the old part of Mexico City.
We're talking to author David Lida. The book is First Stop in the New World, Mexico City, the Capital of the 21st Century. He is a writer and journalist who has lived in Mexico City for much of the past 15 years. You cover a lot in your book about the gap between rich and poor in Mexico City. On the one hand, in Mexico City itself, the poverty isn't nearly as pronounced as it is in the rest of the country, and that most people actually do have a roof over their heads, have a TV, and yet you have the super rich, which
yes,
live in an entirely different world and have an entirely different way of thinking.
I do portraits of certain people, you know, who are emblematic of where the money is and where it isn't. But one thing about yes, on the one hand, half the population of Mexico City lives at or around the poverty level. But compared to a billion or so other people in the world who go to bed hungry at night, they're not doing that badly. I think I would define poverty in Mexico City as more like people who are treading water. And some of them, quite a number of them, although sadly not all of them, manage one way or another to claw their way out of poverty.
And the well-off people who are rich by—
They're filthy rich.
But they don't think of themselves as rich, unless you're Carlos Slim, as you mentioned, the world's richest man.
It is funny. I've never heard anyone refer to himself as rich in Mexico City.
Why is that?
I think it might be considered bad taste or bad form. But I mean, we're talking this. I have a conversation that I recount in the book with a guy, a PR man, young man. You know, he wears clothes that look like he just took them off the pages of a fashion magazine. And he was talking about middle class people in Mexico City. And it turns out he's talking about people who drive expensive foreign cars, you know, have mortgaged million-dollar apartments, take vacations in Europe or New York or L.A. Several times a year, have maids and other people in service for them. You know, not what most people say in the United States would consider middle class. And I think a lot of people just don't have a clue, those people, to the fact that the minimum wage in Mexico City is $5 a day, or any conception at all to what it would be like to try to survive on such low wages.
And a big chunk of that quote-unquote middle class, the well-to-do, are foreigners. Foreigners have a lot better off in Mexico City.
I have always felt personally that I've got a privileged position in Mexico City as a foreigner. And I look around me and I see that, you know, backed up with other with other foreigners. You know, I try not to abuse it. I try to be very respectful of the place I live in. But yeah, I mean, foreigners really, I think, have a great. Are you by any chance? What is your ascendancy ethnically?
My background is Chinese. My parents are Chinese immigrants.
There's a lot of Chinese who are coming into Mexico City. You see more Asians all the time. There's a Koreatown. About a month ago, I went to a bar. In a very nice, really fine area of Mexico City, a Korean bar, and the waitress gave me a menu in Korean. She did not have a Spanish menu, and you know, China. There's a lot of Chinese immigrants coming too.
But you write that Chinatown is pretty much only one block, I think, or one street in the city. So it's not, even though it's a cosmopolitan city in terms of cuisine. I think you said obviously the Mexican food is good, maybe the Italian, the Greek food is good, but not much beyond that.
Well, no. There's a few things. You just have to know where to go. I mean, it took me a really long time. I love Chinese food, but I finally found a good Chinese restaurant in the middle of nowhere. It's in a neighborhood that you'd have no other reason to go to besides this great Chinese restaurant. But you go there, and there's families of 10 Chinese people sitting at circular tables with a lazy Susan in the middle, you know, sharing dishes. So if you know where to go, there's some – they don't always get it right, the foreign food, but it's there.
Let's talk about crime, which has been such a huge part of Mexico City's reputation. And although you do illustrate in your book that it is still a significant problem, you believe in part because of the media, it's been overstated.
Absolutely. Don't get me wrong. It is a dangerous city. It's a tough town and you have to watch your back. But on the other hand, I think I'm sure that the perception far outstrips the reality. You're much more likely to get murdered in nearly any medium to large city in the United States than you are in Mexico City. In Mexico City, you know, bad things can happen. And the real problem is that it's basically a lawless place. I mean, if something happens to you, you know, there are few recourses. I mean, you can't rely on the cops. You can't rely on the judicial system.
It's better that you can't trust the cops. People trust almost everyone more than they do the police.
Absolutely. And it is often difficult, if not impossible, to distinguish the cops from the criminals. But having said that, in all the years, I've lived off and on in Mexico City since 1990. I had one bad incident. I was kidnapped in a taxi cab. We went around in circles on the inner city highways while they tried to get cash from my credit cards from ATM machines. And that was a bad, you know, horrible incident. But that's the only thing that's ever happened to me since 1990. And in New York, where I grew up, I was mugged on the street a lot.
Other foreigners, don't foreigners have personal security?
No, I certainly don't. Look, maybe if you're like, you know, some big executive with a multinational, and they've sold you this bill of goods that you need a car with bulletproof windows and six bodyguards, maybe you go around that way. But I don't, and none of my friends who are foreigners or Mexicans do that. I mean, there are some very wealthy Mexicans that live in terror. I remember I went out with a girl one night. Although she was 29 years old, she lived with her parents. Her mother called her. I mean, she came from a very well-to-do family. Her mother called her like every 20 minutes. When are you coming home? When are you coming home? Because at 11 o'clock, their private security guard was going off duty. Her mother was worried about that 1 minute that she would have to get out of the car in the garage, you know, before the garage door closed. I mean, I think that there's a really out of proportion panic. I mean, the likelihood is that nothing is going to happen.
And the kidnappings that we've heard so much about in the past are not as much of a threat as they used to be.
No, I mean, and this is actually sheer numbers. I mean, again, the statistics. Some kidnappings are not reported, so you have to take the statistics with a grain of salt. But definitely, there are fewer kidnappings by far reported today than there were 10, 12 years ago.
Let's talk about the election. And because we were talking about the relative prosperity, I guess, to the rest of Mexico and the poverty around the world, the relative prosperity of even the poor in Mexico City. And yet at the same time, you had the rise of López Obrador and the appeal of his campaign. So how do we marry the two there?
Well, you know, you have to have a certain perspective. There are women who are supporting children on $5 a day. I mean, some people live in extreme poverty in Mexico, but it's a minority. Most of them, you know, do a little bit better than that. I mean, the point is, what I was getting at is that hunger is an anomaly in Mexico City, unlike many places in the world. I mean, the poor who live in Africa and Asia and you know, many other places in the world are literally starving to death. People don't starve to death in Mexico City. But that doesn't mean that they don't live close to the margin and have very difficult lives. The rise of López Obrador attests to that. I mean, he is a candidate. When he was mayor of Mexico City, many of his most important programs were aimed at those, principally that population. I mean, those people have greater access than ever to services like medical care, schools, you know, free books and pencils and stuff for school programs. The problem is that they're getting paid less and less money. So and the quality of their lives are getting worse. Each of those people has to go like 2 hours to get to work every day and 2 hours to come home. So they have no free time. You get the idea.
And talk about and most of those people depend on the informal market.
Absolutely.
And talk about the tension between that and then you have more and more, you know, these established companies coming in and the monopolies that are controlled by Carlos Slim. And,
sure.
And so talk about the tension there.
Something like half the population, more or less, lives from the informal economy. Most of those people are selling things on the street. Maybe newspapers, maybe pens and pencils, maybe books, chewing gum, rabbits, live rabbits. I mean, I've seen people selling the strangest things on the street.
And hasn't there been an effort to push out a lot of those vendors?
That was one of Mayor Giuliani's recommendations. Rudy Giuliani was hired to give advice to the powers that be in Mexico City on how to improve their crime problem. One of his pieces of advice was to get these people off the street. Nothing happened. I mean, these people are so important to the economy in Mexico City. They took them out of the Centro Histórico, which is this very picturesque downtown district, which has the oldest buildings in the city.
It's kind of the center of the center.
Exactly, exactly. But, you know, we're talking about an area of maybe 10 square blocks that they got them out of. I mean, selling things on the street is a very, very important part of the Mexico City economy. But also maids who clean up people's houses. Most people who clean industrial buildings or even government buildings are being paid off the books or being paid outsourced by a contractor. They have no benefits. They don't pay taxes. They don't have insurance, of course. And most people are surviving informally.
And bottom line, we only have a couple seconds left. You
sure
believe, you know, I mean, and it seems obvious. Any American has to be paying attention to Mexico City and its influence on the U.S. But we've run out of time. David Lida, the author of First Stop in the New World, Mexico City, the Capital of the 21st Century, from Penguin Books. He will be at the Mexican Cultural Institute in Los Angeles at 5 p.m. on Saturday, June 21st, and at Libreria Martinez in Santa Ana on Thursday, June 26th. It's a wonderful book that has a lot of colorful descriptions of Mexico's food. One last pitch, 2 seconds.
If it's possible, I have a website, www.davidlida.com.